Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Medicaid Providers and the Supremacy Clause Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 22, 2012, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Douglas v. Independent Living Center of Southern California, etc. The question in this series of cases was whether Medicaid providers and recipients can bring suit under the U.S. Constitution's Supremacy Clause to enforce a federal Medicaid law. In their view, the law preempts state Medicaid statutes that would reduce payments to providers, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit agreed. In an opinion delivered by Justice Breyer, the court, by a vote of 5-4, vacated the Ninth Circuit decisions and remanded the case for further proceedings. Because a federal agency had approved the state statutes at issue during the course of the litigation, the court held, the case should be remanded to the Ninth Circuit for determination as to whether the party's dispute should be resolved under the Administrative Procedure Act. Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined Justice Breyer's opinion. Chief Justice Roberts filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. To discuss the case, we have Rick Hills, who is the William T. Comfort III Professor of Law at New York University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Hills.
Now, you can make a good case that Douglas versus Independent Living Center is one of the most boring, important federalism cases of the term. If the individual mandate litigation, which is going to get 2 hours of oral argument before the court, is the most interesting, but in some sense, long-term inconsequential case, Douglas is the most technical and dry, but in the long term, perhaps even more consequential. I'll explain that by contrasting the two cases. The individual mandate case, Health and Human Services versus Florida, is a case about a constitutional test that might not make any difference. That is to say, there's lots of ways that Florida acknowledges federal government could impose an individual mandate on individuals by making it, for instance, conditional on working at a job affecting interstate commerce or driving a car or buying insurance or renting a house, holding down a job. Any sort of commercial activity could be conditioned on buying federal health insurance. So it might be a very easy test to escape, even though obviously if the Obama administration lost, it would be very disappointing for them and politically embarrassing. Now consider Douglas versus Independent Living Center. In this decision handed down last Wednesday, the court ducked a decision about whether beneficiaries of Medicaid have a right under the Constitution's Supremacy Clause to enforce the Medicaid grant program's requirements against the state of California. Those federal conditions require that California maintain payments, quoting the statute, sufficient to enlist enough providers so that care and services are available under the plan submitted by the state. Now, after California slashed payments across the board to providers by 10%, a bunch of home care providers, Independent Living Center of Southern California among them, sued. And they alleged that this 10% cut effectively was preempted by federal law, and so that they were entitled to raise the federal statute, the Medicaid statute, under the Supremacy Clause. Now, that's a familiar kind of strategy with preemption. We're all familiar with federal statutory defenses where, say, an ERISA health plan claims that a state cannot regulate it in certain ways because the regulation is preempted by ERISA's preemption clause. That's sort of a routine stock and trade of the court's term. Here, the unusual nature of the preemption is that the home care providers are alleging that what's preempted is the state's not giving them money. And the question before the court was whether this kind of cause of action is permitted. Now, the difficulty is that the court had long held that these kinds of Medicaid spending statutes, indeed spending statutes in general that had grant conditions tied to money sent to the states, did not create an implied private causes of action authorizing beneficiaries of the program to sue. There are federal grant programs that create such private causes of action, most famously Title IX. That's the statute, Title IX of the Higher Education Act of 1972, that says if a institution, public or private, gets federal money, then they can't discriminate or exclude or deny people benefits under the federally financed education program. Thus, universities who take the federal buck have to let military recruiters onto campus or have to have equal sports opportunities for men and women. So those kinds of private causes of action are fine. Notice that those aren't typically private causes of action to demand that the state give you money. Benefits programs are different. The court has long held, since the mid-80s, in cases like Blessing versus Freestone, and more recently, Gonzaga University versus Doe, that when some grantee gets federal money that they're supposed to pay out according to some plan or system that is mutually agreed upon by the federal government and the grantee, third parties who benefit from that money aren't necessarily entitled to sue. The theory is that the plan or the system created by federal statute does not create individual rights. It creates a more systemic system of collective governance, and so that there's no entitlement for a private party to sort of appoint themselves as a private attorney general and sue. So that was the obstacle that Independent Living Center faced in this case. They tried to get around it by analogizing their lawsuit to ex parte Young. The theory is that just as at the turn of the century, when a state attorney general tries to regulate a railroad in a way that's inconsistent with federal law, the railroad can raise the federal defense as a shield against that state action. So, too, Independent Living Center can raise the Medicaid statute as a shield against getting their money cut. Well, if you think about that for a while, it's pretty easy to see that that'll do a complete end run around the ban on private causes of action. Instead of styling the private cause of action an implied cause of action under the Medicaid statute or an implied cause of action under Section 1983, enforcing a civil right, plaintiffs will simply call it a private cause of action under the Supremacy Clause. And courts generally don't like such bald circumvention. This court was not really a big exception. They did not recognize that particular remedy. Instead, they ducked the issue entirely. They did not deny that such a remedy could exist. They did not recognize that such a remedy could exist. Instead, the majority, in an opinion by Stephen Breyer, remanded the entire case to the Ninth Circuit so that the Ninth Circuit could decide whether the plaintiffs should proceed against the CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the federal agency in charge of supervising the grant program. And you might say, why is CMS in this lawsuit? You never mentioned CMS. You mentioned California, and you mentioned these home care providers. Well, CMS came into the lawsuit, or came into the picture at least, after oral argument. A month after oral argument, CMS actually approved some, but not all, of the cuts that California made to its Medicaid plan. And so Breyer said, for the majority, a five-vote majority, the Ninth Circuit should decide whether this approval by the federal agency of what the state did is consistent with the Administrative Procedure Act's arbitrary and capricious standard under Section 706. In other words, he converted a private claim against the state to an administrative petition against CMS. And that was sort of an interesting leisure domain, essentially substituting defendants. But the basic idea is that he wanted some judicial review of the relationship between the feds and the states. Now, why do I say that that's a very important decision? Well, it's important because, unlike the individual mandate litigation, there actually is a lot of practical money and practical rights riding on how you provide remedies for federal poverty programs. Lots of these programs, not just Medicaid, but Title I of the ACEA, which includes No Child Left Behind, Community Development Block Grants, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, Head Start, the Food Stamp Program, are administered by states. But states have incentives to cheat when they're redistributing money to indigent households by diverting the money to ends other than relief of indigency. That's not because states are Scrooges. It's because they fear becoming a welfare magnet in a federal system in which indigent households and taxpayers can freely migrate across state lines. So they're inclined to shirk on their duty to help the indigent in hopes that the indigent go to a more generous neighbor. Given that all money is green, it's hard for federal agencies to monitor what happens to federal money. How can you tell if the states are not reducing their own fiscal efforts on behalf of the poor by exactly the amount of the federal grant? And in particular, when you're dealing with a federal insurance program, how can one tell if states are spending enough on health care or compensating home care providers enough? That turns out to be a really tricky problem. Now, one way that federal agencies can police this relationship is by threatening to terminate the grant when states misbehave. But there's a fairly obvious problem with that remedy. The states might turn down the grant. After all, it's money for indigent households, and they might want to avoid attracting indigent households by being generous with a combination of federal and state money. And in any case, it might not be a very credible threat for the federal government to terminate aid that's to assist the very parties that the federal agency is charged with helping. In other words, it's almost destroying the village just to say we're going to cut off your federal money for health care for indigent households in order to get them to provide money for indigent households. So coming up with another remedy is helpful. The difficulty is the court, and indeed the Obama administration that filed an amicus brief, is very hostile to the private litigation remedy directly against the state. The basic idea is that they don't buy the analogy to preemption. The analogy to preemption says if the state cuts off federal money in violation of federal conditions, that's just like the state regulating us in violation of federal prohibitions. But the problem is that that conflates access to the state's treasury with freedom to be left alone by the state. And that conflation is one that the Obama administration, both at oral argument and their amicus brief, and the court was not willing to accept. So the court ducked whether you could have such a Supremacy Clause preemption remedy to get at state money, and instead said, well, even if you can't sue the state directly, you can go to the federal agency and demand that they review the state program and review the state cuts to make sure they're consistent with the federal statute. Now, how effective a remedy is this administrative remedy? Well, one difficulty with that kind of administrative remedy is that it's going to be extraordinarily deferential. Justice Breyer quoted or cited Chevron and Brand X, two opinions that say that federal courts should defer to administrative agencies' interpretation of ambiguous federal schemes. And obviously, the federal standards here, sufficient payments, is pretty ambiguous. So there's a strong sense if the federal agency gives some plausible justification, they're going to win this case. Another difficulty is the court in Douglas was helped fortuitously by the fact that the CMS actually made a decision about California's program. But sometimes federal agencies just sit on their hands. They don't do anything. If a federal agency does that, can a party sue? Could, for instance, a healthcare provider sue and say, look, do something about California. Bring an action against them. Pull their grant or at least demand that they send their plan to you for review. That's a difficult question. It's not clear that pure agency inaction, that's not discrete inaction, that's not a refusal to do something specific, is reviewable action under the Administrative Procedure Act. So that's a complicated question. It's not clear that this administrative remedy is going to be all that effective. But it obviously is responding to five members of the court's nervousness that states can't be 100% trusted with federal money, with redistributive programs, that states have incentives with such programs that require at least some kind of judicial monitoring. Simply allowing the agency to have freedom from any kind of judicial and private review, something the court was not entirely comfortable with. That's why I say the case is extremely important, because these programs are extremely important.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.